Dispatch, pockets of fire all around.
Dear Chief, much has happened since we last spoke. Welcome to Dear Chief Podcast, where your hosts and their guests share the 411 of being married to the people who respond to 911s. Take a peek into fire family life and get unabashed advice on how to prevent forest fires in your marriage. Now, here's your hosts, two seasoned fire wives, Audra and Chelsea.
We're getting ready to take a break from recording for a few months. Fire season is already rearing its ugly head, and we're feeling the chaos of the end of school year and May craziness with our kids. Speaking of craziness with kids, today we've invited Jesse Brown from Siblings on the Spectrum to join us and talk about navigating family life in a first responder household with neurodivergent children. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jesse Brown is a fire wife to her husband, Phil, who is 14 years with a large department outside of DC and has been captain on his ship for 3 years. Together, they have two children, Lila, almost 11, and Buddy, 9. They both are autistic, and Buddy is non-speaking with several other disabilities as well. For nearly a decade, Jessie has devoted much of her time to researching and trialing the best ways to raise and support each of her two very different kids on the spectrum. 2 years ago, she started an advocacy page on Instagram to not only make connections with other moms who understand, but to help spread awareness about all that autism can be, and most importantly, encourage parents and professionals with ideas of ways to support their children and clients in neurodiversity-affirming ways. And Chelsea and I both have neurodivergent kids, so we are very, very aware of this topic, and we'd love to hear your opinion on it.
Awesome. Well, then you know that, first of all, as a spouse of a firefighter, that is a lifestyle in and of itself. And then you add kids into the mix, and now it's a whole other ball game. But then when you're a fire family with kids who have disabilities, it's just a completely different world. We've got the unique schedule that, of course, comes with its perks of getting them home for longer stretches. But in exchange, that means them being gone for longer stretches, as we know. So the challenges of being basically a single parent for that chunk of time is, you know, with any typical child you're raising, it's going to be tough. It's a hard task. But when the child is physically or neurologically disabled or both, it then adds a significant layer to those challenges.
Yeah. We like to say default parent here because we're very aware of the single parents and the difference between the two. Tell us about your journey with the kids and the diagnosis, and give us the backstory.
Yeah, so basically my son Buddy, he's completely non-speaking. We always knew, probably at birth, I just knew something was different. He started actually early intervention services before he even got his diagnosis. And then he and Lila both were given their assessment on the same day by the same person, and then they actually received their diagnosis on the same day over the phone, which was a big day. Lots of feelings that day. So it's interesting. We knew with my son, I think everybody knew, everyone that was in our lives knew. But with Lila, we really didn't know. We just knew her as her. We didn't know until she was almost 4, when I was actually just, you know, diving into so much research for my son to learn things about autism for him, to support him. And I came across this YouTube channel called Ask an Autistic, the most adorable, maybe 20 or so year old, as my guess, autistic woman who was talking about echolalia. And I had never heard of that word before. Now it's like, it's such a huge part of my life that I look back and I kind of like chuckle at the fact that I've never heard that word before. So then I took a deep dive because something hit me in that moment, like the glass kind of shattered. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is Lila. I feel like I'm looking at my kid in 20 years. So I texted the link to my husband, who was at the station at the time. And I said, I think we need to get her tested as well. And he was like, no. What, you know, no, you know. But then I sent the link and he was like, curse word. You're right. You're absolutely right. And So we got them both evaluated. They both got their diagnosis the same day. But yeah, that echolalia is really what made her stand out because she was hitting all of her other milestones, unlike my son, who was not hitting any of his milestones traditionally. So it was just an interesting series of events. The emotional roller coaster was just indescribable because, you know, as parents of neurodivergent children, you have that process that you kind of have to take that is important, in my opinion, to grieve the life that you thought you were going to have. And so for me, I feel like that day, I remember just wallowing for like a day, just letting myself have that time. And then after that, I was like, all right, enough's enough. Now I have to get to work. Not to say I don't have my bad moments in my days, obviously, but overall I was like, all right, this is what it is. This is what we're going to get to work with. So I will say one thing that is definitely in relation to being a fire family, I feel like burnout, intensity, frequency for everyone in the house has definitely been like on another level. My husband currently is captain for his shift, as you mentioned, for a busy department at a DC. He works 24 on and 24 off for 5 days. And then he has 4 days off, which I love those 4 days. But he doesn't actually get the entire 4 day off. He ends up having to work a lot of overtime just because of the medical expense aspect of having children who need extra support and extra resources and all of that. So it's been quite a journey. You know, it's just different. A lot of people say, I don't know how you do it. Like, everybody has stresses. Ours are just different.
Yeah. So talk to us about those stressors and the unique circumstances of a fire family with neurodivergent children.
Yeah, sure. So like I mentioned, that's his shift. That's his schedule. Lila is speaking. She's a chatty Cathy. She is pretty much, I wouldn't say on track with her peers, but typically as far as like traditional milestones and traditional development, she tends to fit in, so to speak, a little bit better with ones that are maybe 3 or so years younger than her. My son, like I mentioned, he's non-speaking. He also has extremely high support needs, other physical disabilities as well. And we live in Virginia, and it's one of the worst states to live in with disabled children. And he actually was denied any medical support whatsoever from the state for years. And this is my kid that walks in a room and you know he's autistic. You know he has severely high support needs. So we haven't even tried for Lila to push it because we're like, she's not going to get support because they're going to say, oh, she's too, you know, her support needs are so low. She's not. We haven't even hardly tried for her because of how insanely ridiculous our experience was for Buddy. But finally, he just received Medicaid based off of his disability not even 2 years ago. So for years, in order to give him the therapies that he needed, we had to pay out of pocket. The medical treatment he needs for his disability with his legs, he sees a musculoskeletal specialist for years, and that had to be out of pocket. Other things were just piling up and piling up. And then, of course, we never want to leave Lila, despite her having quote unquote low support needs. She still needs support too. And so we've always tried hard to not leave her on the back burner, so to speak, comparing her issues with him and his, the struggles he has. So we, to this day, I mean, I'm an open book. I'll just say it. We're drowning in debt to this day because even with his amazing fire department, his department is one of the bigger in the nation, and they are considered to be very good as far as benefits, but that's for a typical family. So to this day, you know, the financial aspect, we're drowning in credit card buildup because of having to just use a credit card to pay for my son's doctor's appointment. So with that being said, my husband is just constantly signing up for overtime. So those 4 days really become 2 days. Maybe we get a 3 day stint with him. And then I have been working for the last couple of years from home, along with homeschooling the kids. I would have to say that financial strain, while I feel like we're in a way used to it. We're used to just kind of living paycheck to paycheck and not being able to go on vacations as much as we would like to. It just kind of is what it is. We try to have that balance though of, okay, if there is something or somewhere that, especially Lila, she just loves to travel and we don't get to do it very often. But back in January, all the four of us went on a trip that was basically centered around her. We went out to California. It's the first time we ever went out west at all. To did the whole Universal Studios, Disneyland, all the stuff because of her major obsession with all things Super Mario Bros. That was Lila Day. You know, it was amazing. So that we were gone for 4 weeks because we're like, you know, in order to make this an actual vacation that all four of us enjoy and it isn't just a chore, that we actually really make the most of it, we have to give Buddy a day in between everything we do. So we go to the park one day, the next day we're chilling at the hotel and he's regulating on a screen or he's just relaxing. So yeah, we were gone for almost 4 weeks. We did California and Arizona. We were in Phoenix. I incorporated a conference while I was out there to, again, further like help my kids. So that, again, those types of things we don't do often, but when we do, we kind of go big and just make it worthwhile. But again, put it on the credit card because we're already in debt, but we also want to give our kids experiences in life and not, you know, let their entire childhood go by without doing anything. So we try to find that balance of, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that, but okay, you know what? This, let's just do it and let's just take a year to pay it off, you know? So yeah, it definitely can be draining, but we try to find our groove, find that balance. But yeah, I had asked, you know, some extra challenges in addition to the financial thing. The fact that I had to pull both kids out of the school system was big. They both were in great schools for the area, but as a whole, the school system just massively has failed both of my children. It's not set up. The system is not set up to support kids like mine. So there's obviously mental and physical toll that can take on me, you know, homeschooling both of them. I've homeschooled Lila for a couple of years now, started during the pandemic actually. And because she made such tremendous growth that was unexpected with her language and her communication during the pandemic, being home with me, we said, we're not sending her back. She's made so much more progress at home than she ever did at school. As a gestalt language processor, a child who uses echolalia as a primary way to communicate, we discovered, you know, that's not being honored in school. So let's figure out a way to honor it at home. It was almost like I was her one-on-one speech therapist, you know, 24/7, instead of sending her to school where she can't raise her hand when she has a thought. She has to keep it to herself and then she loses it, you know? So we just kept her home. My son, I felt like there's no way I can do this. There's no way that I can homeschool both kids. Between my two kids, he is definitely, like I mentioned, he has the highest of support needs you can think of and needs assistance and help in every single angle of life, and most likely always will. He's the sweetest. He's also my most draining child. And I didn't think I could do it. But unfortunately, I didn't really have a choice. He started coming home with like a different bruise, a different scratch. And they were pretty good about communicating why, you know, what happened. And it was always an accident from another child, or he fell off the playground. And that's the thing, is he needed that one-on-one, but the school system doesn't provide enough support to the teachers and to the para professionals that they get burnt out. They get overwhelmed. It's not their fault. They're there doing their best. But the problem is further to the top, you know, like they're not providing what these people need to properly look after kids like mine. So Buddy was getting hurt a lot, and it wasn't serious, but it was just way too frequent. So I just didn't feel comfortable anymore with the thought that this kid has always been in the 110th percentile in height, 100% in weight. Like, he's a big kid and he's strong. He's this gentle giant. He's sweet as pie, but he's big. And I can't send him to school knowing that his normal para took a sick day and the substitute that's there is 75 years old. And she can't catch my son if he falls off the playground. She's he'll snap her like a twig. You know, I have severe anxiety in general, and that combined with just knowing that they're not receiving the proper support, they're so understaffed. My son needs one-on-one constant attention and care. His care and attention was being split with, you know, three or four other students like him. So I didn't really feel like I had a choice. I had to pull him out, and that has been interesting. This has been the first year that I've homeschooled both of them, and I'm very tired, but I feel overall they are happier. They are more regulated for the most part. You know, Buddy struggles definitely a lot more with his meltdowns. His sensory profile is just ever shifting. We just kind of have to pivot as we go along. We're in a pivoting stage right now. I'm really hoping that he's not getting too close to prepubescence, but if that is possible, because I feel a little bit of a shift happening with him and his regulation. So hence why I just quit my job. He had a really severe meltdown a couple weeks ago that put Lila in harm's way. Nothing severe. She was totally fine, but it just kind of gave me a little wake up call that, okay, this has worked for up until now, but now, like I said, his sensory diet is needing to be changed. So, you know, I can't be on my computer Monday through Friday in the morning and then getting to them for school after. I have to be just, let's wake up. Let's take our time. Let's eat breakfast. Let's go out. Let's go to the place. Let's get him that sensory input and output that he needs in order to set his day up for success. And I can't do it by working a Monday through Friday. So that will be an adventure, but I feel good about it. It's not easy, but I feel like it has overall, they seem healthier and happier. So,
yeah, I love what you said about it. It's unfortunately not the para's fault and the teacher's fault. There's not enough of them. And mm-hmm. The school districts in our country were not designed to deal with special needs children, unfortunately. And it's so frustrating for the parents whose kids need those services and they don't have them available. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people take those frustrations on the teachers and the paras, and it's not their fault. It's
no,
they're doing the best that they can with what they have, with the volume of students that need that one-on-one support. I think the best thing that you can do, I know Chelsea and I do it all the time, is we are now our child's advocate and that leader for all things special needs. We have to be the ones to say, yes, no, this is what they need. This is what we think is best going to support them. And we have to make sure that it gets done, because I'm not homeschooling my kids. Sorry.
I get it. I definitely get that.
It's so frustrating, but you know, it's hard for the paras. I think I know in our district, it's so they want the kids to succeed and they want to help all of them. They just they're only one person and they can only help so many people. And I think it's important to recognize that they are really doing, for the most part, most of them are doing the best that they can. But it's 100% accurate. When somebody comes in and subs and has never been with my child, just let me know so I can keep my kid home that day.
Because
I'm not sending them to school with a sub. Like, not
exactly.
We can't do it. Like, just let me know. Okay, cool. We're not going to school today because I can't deal with that. Like, and I don't want to put my kid in that situation or the sub in that situation. That's definitely the frustrating part for sure.
Yeah, we definitely at the end there just stopped sending him as well. And I just told admin, like, look, as far as his attendance goes, it just is what it is. I'm not sending him when I know that especially his main para, that was just, it's like his little soulmate. They're very close. She was his para for 2 years, and she and I are very close. She's become like family now. She's actually now our respite worker at home. So that's a whole long story. I don't want to like talk too much about her just because she, you know, she has relationships still with people in the school system. But I will say that it got to the point where she would just tell us, because she knew me and she knew how I felt and what kind of mom that I was and how bad my anxiety was and all of that. She just would tell me like, hey, heads up, I got a migraine today. I'm not going to be going in. And I'd be like, 10-4, got it. Bud's having a personal day today. So yeah, I 100% get that. It's just another layer to all of this that unless you know, you just don't know. But yeah, I definitely agree. It is not at all the fault of the teachers or the paras. Like it's the higher ups that are not providing the proper support and not taking it seriously that they need a lot more support, a lot more, and they need more money too. I can't even imagine the burnout. Oh my gosh. Like even just with my son's paraprofessional, she told me what she made because I remember telling her, oh, well, I'm sorry if you work as a respite worker. I don't know if you want to take this job because it only pays this. And she was like, oh, well, that's what I make at school. And I was shocked, absolutely floored. It's disgusting. Their jobs that they're doing, the physical labor in itself, lifting children that are in wheelchairs, lifting kids like my son who, you know, and also chasing after elopers like my son. Like it is a lot of work. And what they're making is trash. It's actually really disappointing. So yeah, it's not them. They're not all of them, obviously. There's some really, really crummy people out there who are not in the right field. But for the most part, I feel pretty confident to say that it's not on them. They're doing their best. They're in that field for a reason. It's usually because they have a passion for this sort of thing and they really, really have beautiful hearts. And I definitely feel for them because they want to make a difference. And teachers as well, they are burning out. They are quitting because they are so undersupported, so understaffed, so underpaid. It's just not feasible anymore. You can only burn out, but so many fumes, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough one. So switching gears from school to home, what mm-hmm. advice would you give to first responder parents who may be feeling overwhelmed or isolated in their journey of raising neurodivergent children?
What I think of first is, you know, I think of my husband, you know, he tries to compartmentalize, you know, what happens at work. He can do that all he wants, but the fact is he's human. And so it affects him. How could it not? But he comes home from working hard as a first responder, caring for others, and as a leader of his crew, being up all night, and rather than get some sleep, like I know a lot are able to do the second they get off shift and come home in the morning, he doesn't. He goes right into a whole other caretaker role with me. And unlike at the firehouse, he has to sort of shift his mindset from being in that leader position to now sort of being led by me and catching up to get on the same page with me as, like you mentioned, the default parent who's, you know, he's been the captain of this house while he's been away. So having to shift all of a sudden, like that can be a little bit tricky, but we're a very good team. We usually, when it comes to parenting, we're a great team, but with that obviously comes challenges, heavy challenges in our marriage. So what I would say is if you're not careful, you can find yourself in a slump in your marriage, just getting through each day, putting the kids first, making sure they're not just healthy and happy, truly happy. But then what can happen is then you're left, the two of you as the mom and dad are left with basically you become roommates, you know, you have those phases. Some are longer than you'd like to admit. And in our case, we can become at times co-parents who are best friends, which that's great, but it's not. We're married. We should get a little piece of the pie for each other too, you know? So it's great to be each other's best friends. We are, but real talk, you know, we struggle. We struggle with not having any family on either side to help that's nearby. Of course, being parents to two autistic children, especially one who has very, you know, high support needs when it comes to communication as well as safety, we don't have that privilege of just hiring a babysitter. It's so much more complex, obviously. So I would say it can be a really, really difficult thing to have any energy left for each other. And we can really start to feel that shift, you know, so we can always feel when we're growing apart. Sometimes it lasts for a few hours, sometimes several weeks. But I think it's so important to keep in mind that if you have those really, really raw, really tough, really important conversations that are not fun, and oftentimes you're both crying it out, or at least one of you, that's important to have those raw conversations when those kids go to bed and you just get it all out. My husband and I just had one a couple weeks ago. I mean, I was at a breaking point and we came back to each other though. And we always do. We always come back to each other and usually a little bit stronger than before, but we can't put off those tough conversations. I would definitely say that that's one thing to really, really look out for and pay attention to for other families that are kind of in our boat. It adds a whole other level to things as far as marriage goes in itself. So if we aren't carving out time for ourselves to talk, to be intimate, sometimes you have to schedule things that you never thought that you would have to schedule. You know, it's just, it is what it is, you know? So it's just important to have not only those tough convos, but also one thing that I think of is just so much forgiveness is required. Forgiveness is, in our case, the utmost important quality to have in a marriage. The both of you have to forgive constantly. And that's one thing that I will say, my husband isn't the best communicator. He's working on that currently. I don't think he'll mind me saying he actually just started going to therapy a few months ago, and it has helped tremendously with our communication. I'm really, really excited. I'm really proud of him. I'm really looking forward to that because, you know, he fought it. He fought it for up until just a few months ago. He fought doing therapy. He always said, oh, there's someone in, you know, the HR provides if I ever need it. I don't need it. I'm fine. I can compartmentalize. I got this. I leave work at the door. I got this. But as his wife, I just knew he's human. You can't leave work at the door. Not fully. It's just not possible. You are a human being. So that has definitely helped. And I know that he would definitely recommend that to any and all, anyone as a first responder. That type of job, you see things, you go through things, you feel things that a lot of other people don't experience. And you have to have some sort of outlet. If you're just letting it fester inside and thinking, oh, I'm fine, it will carry over whether you like it or not. It will carry over into the home. And so I'm just really, really proud of him. That has made a significant change. It has improved how we communicate with each other so much lately. And I'm just excited to see how much better things go with that. I've also done therapy. I currently am not, but I have done it. I feel like it's probably about that time I maybe pick it back up again because of some things shifting in life, like I mentioned a little bit about. So yeah, I think therapy is a massive help and support. I would recommend it to anyone and everyone who parent neurodivergent children or parent disabled children. I would recommend it to even childless couples that are fire fans. Like, I just really feel like it's important. I view it as sort of, you know, we go get a physical at our doctor's office once a year. You know, our brain is a physical organ like any other physical organ. So why are we not getting a mental checkup as just a preventative, proactive measure? It just makes sense to me. So that is something that's huge. I feel like would be so beneficial for anybody and everybody.
All right. So right before we do hot seat, is there anything else you'd like to share about your experience as a fire wife with neurodivergent children that you feel is important for others to know?
I want to quickly just mention the joys in it too, because I feel like obviously that's kind of the point, is talking about the hardships. That's what this episode was all about. But, you know, I do feel hard pressed to mention the joys too, the positives. So I wanted to mention that being the parent of a neurodivergent child or multiple neurodivergent children, I think it's probably a sort of a universal thing for all parents of children who are neurodivergent, is that every win is, no matter how small, huge. So you have all these parents of neurotypical kids who are jumping up and down and shouting and praising their kids who are riding their bike on their own for the first time without training wheels, or making their first score at a school sports game, or being announced as someone's husband or wife as they walk into their wedding reception to have their first dance as a married couple. These parents are just over the moon that their kids are meeting these huge traditional milestones. You know, they've dreamed of those things their whole life. But then as parents with neurodivergent kids, we had those exact same hopes and dreams for our kids. But we learned very quickly that we have to shift our mindset quite a bit when it comes to the milestones of our kids. So we're jumping up and down and shouting for them because they touched or smelled a food that we've been putting on their plate for months and months and months, just on the chance they might explore it one day finally. We're jumping up and down because they're able to snap a cap back on a marker for the first time at 10 years old. That's literally just happened a couple weeks ago with my son for the first time. He's not even 10. Like, he has never been able to snap a marker cap on a marker. And I was crying when he did it for the first time. And that sounds crazy, but that's our life, you know? It's just different. We're jumping up and down when our child is able to use our AAC device to tell us to go away. Other parents would view that as disrespectful or something they had to correct, but we are welcoming it and we're celebrating it. So while sometimes it can be sad, it might seem sad, the thought of our kids not having those traditional milestones or the thought of them not being able to do something that other kids can do, we just have very different things that we are celebrating. And in our family's experience, we just are constantly celebrating every day. So in that way, we're looking for the joy in so many situations. And I feel like we actually have more opportunity to celebrate those wins than with neurotypical kids in a way. So we can kind of shift our mindset in that way. We just have watched our kids thrive in so many ways that we never would have expected when we first received their diagnosis. And then two, I know I've rambled on, but one big joy for Buddy that I have really enjoyed is watching his progress with his AAC device has just been absolutely amazing. And for those that don't know, AAC stands for augmentative and alternative communication. He's completely non-speaking, like I mentioned. His AAC device is his voice. We call it his words. And we refer to him as being non-speaking, not nonverbal, because he does have words. These are his words. So his device lets him get those words out. So he's really taken off with that lately. And it just makes all of the work in modeling consistently, modeling that language with this device makes it all well worth it. And for my daughter, Lila, her huge interest lately in all things neurodiversity has been so cool. She's recently asked so many questions and has learned so much about her brain, her brother's brain, even mine and her dad's brains. She's craving to learn more and more about neurodiversity and autism and the importance of being affirming and kind to everyone. And for being not even 11, her vocabulary these days about this topic is something I'm incredibly proud of. The other day she said, "Mom, I want to design a sticker and I want to sell it. And I want it to say, be inclusive, not ableist." I was like, okay, we can do that. You know, that's great. But she will educate kids out in public at the playground. She came home one day after going to Chick-fil-A and said, "Oh, I told a girl who was hiding from Buddy." She was hiding because she thought he was like different. She thought it was weird that he was pacing back and forth and flapping his arms and being loud. And I told her, "You know, you really shouldn't be hiding from him because he's different. He's stimming because he's happy. He's autistic and so am I," you know. So those moments, I wouldn't have that joy if my kids weren't autistic. If she wasn't autistic, I don't know how inclusive I would internally be. You know, we all have a little bit of that internalized ableism. And so I feel that that is one massive joy that I can celebrate every day is my girl who is autistic herself. She is an advocate for herself and for others like her brother. And that has just been one of the most rewarding things out of all of this to see.
That's really awesome that you've raised a proactive daughter. That's really all we can ask for as parents, I think. All right, we're going to switch to the hot seat. Audra has muted and turned off her camera because her internet is cutting out. And so she's still here listening, but is trying to keep it so that our recording does not totally take a poop on us. So just so you know. All right, so here we go. Hot seat. Series of questions. Just answer as candidly as you'd like. And here we go. If you could have dinner with three people, dead or alive, who would they be and why?
Oh my gosh. Taylor Swift. I feel like I'd be in trouble with Lila if I didn't say Taylor Swift. I would love to have a dinner with my dad who just passed away about a year and a half ago. It was unexpected. So, you know, not being able to say goodbye kind of sucks a little bit more. So I would love to be able to have one more conversation. And then a third person. Oh my goodness. I'm not good with the hot seat stuff. Dolly Parton. Boom.
Dolly Parton and Taylor Swift at the same table.
You know, I'm a mess because I basically answered how my daughter would answer. I'm like, oh, I assume she's going to be at this dinner. So who would make her so happy to have them at the table? It's easier to answer for her than for me.
Do you like pineapple on pizza?
No. Disgusting.
And the last question, are there any books or movies you would recommend to our listeners?
I would say just maybe keeping in the topic of things. I just recently watched a documentary called You Have No Idea. I believe it's on Amazon. You Have No Idea. It is an amazing documentary that I feel like is important for people, not just who have autistic children, but actually I think even more so who don't have autistic kids, for people to understand a little bit of our life and the fears and the emotional aspect of things that we have as our kids, the thought of them growing into adulthood as autistic individuals. So I think that that documentary is very important for everybody to watch. So as far as books go, I would say, also in keeping with the topic, I would recommend The Reason I Jump, which is like super short, super brief, to the point way to look into the brain of an actual autistic person. And then I also think that the book Uniquely Human by Dr. Barry Prezant is like crucial. If your child just got a diagnosis of autism, if you love someone with autism that you want to learn how to connect with, that is probably the book that I would recommend starting off with first to really, truly understand. And then there's a book that I'm currently reading, like it just started. I know it's going to be good because the author, like I vouch for her. So I'll go ahead and say that I'm getting ready to read Ready, Set, Connect. It's by a speech pathologist, Jessie Ginsburg. I think I'm pronouncing her name right. I'm sorry. She's Sensory SLP on Instagram. And I'm excited to dive into her book. It seems like it's going to be short and sweet read.
All right. So any last thoughts before we sign out?
One thing I will say as like a last thought maybe is that there are so many parents that have their child get their diagnosis and it is a huge wave of just shock and grief and whatnot, which is totally valid. All feelings are valid, obviously. But I will say that if anyone's listening that is new at this, it gets better if you find the right village. Social media has been an amazing, amazing resource for me personally. And I've made so many great connections with not only other more seasoned parents, but also speech pathologists and neurodiversity affirming teachers and occupational therapists and whatnot. And I feel like, unfortunately, so-called professional, medical professionals, doctors, they don't know squat about autism. They barely cover it in school. Like they just don't know. So make those connections. Don't ever feel pressured to do any type of therapy over another. Don't ever feel pressured to do any therapy if it's not right for your kid, if you feel like it's too much. Go with your gut, but also make those connections and listen to both people that are parents that have been through it already. And also it's important to listen to autistic adults, listen to their voices because those will be your kids eventually. And it's super important to place a high value on everybody, you know, let everybody have a seat at the table and help you navigate something that seems scary now. As long as you just kind of create that mindset for yourself that you don't need to try to find a cure for autism, but rather try to find the best ways to support your child. That's what being neurodiversity affirming means. And it's so important to connect with your child, meet them where they're at, presume competence, let them lead. All those things will help you to be so much more successful. And I wish that I had known those things way back, you know, when we first got their diagnosis. I would have been so much better prepared and we would have been happier and found our groove so much sooner. So it's going to be okay. Your kid is still the same child that they were before their diagnosis. So let's just dive in and find ways to best support them rather than trying to find ways to get them to fit in better with society. Let's maybe try and do a 180 on that and try to help society to understand the importance of finding ways and creating ways to be inclusive to everyone.
Amen. Okay, Jessie, thank you so much for being with us today. For our listeners, if you want to learn more about Jessie and the advocacy work she's doing, or just have a question for her, you can reach her on Instagram through Siblings on the Spectrum. She also has a website, siblingsonthespectrum.com. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Find us on social media at Dear Chiefs Podcast and online at DearChiefs.com. Tune in weekly for the 25,000 foot view of loving a first responder. Audra and Chelsea, over and out.